Hello, and welcome to this PER Spectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
This activity is supported by an educational grant from Replimune. Over 100,000 people are diagnosed with melanoma in the United States each year, with incidences continuing to rise. Over the past decade, immune checkpoint inhibitors have been the cornerstone of therapy for advanced melanoma. However, our deeper understanding of melanoma's unique tumor microenvironment has expanded the role of interventional radiologists, who now frequently administer therapies directly into melanoma lesions. Today's episode explores exciting developments surrounding intratumorally injected oncolytic viral therapies as treatments for patients with advanced melanoma who have progressed on immune checkpoint inhibitors. Once directly injected, these viruses selectively infect melanoma cells, triggering tumor cell lysis and release of tumor-specific neoantigens. This process activates a potent systemic immune response, not only targeting injected lesions, but also attacking metastatic disease elsewhere in the body. Today's episode covers some of the key themes shared during a recent live symposium titled Empowering Interventional Radiologists in the Emerging Era of Oncolytic Immunotherapies for Melanoma. Our expert faculty includes three melanoma specialists whose combined clinical and translational research experience offers practical insights into the coordinated care required between medical oncologists and interventional radiologists. Dr. Yana Najjar is a medical oncologist and associate professor of medicine, serving as the director of the Clinical and Translational Research Center at UPMC Hillman Cancer Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She has been a principal investigator for several groundbreaking clinical trials, including those exploring oncolytic virus therapies for advanced melanoma. Dr. Raul Sheth is an associate professor in interventional radiology at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. Dr. Sheth specializes in advanced interventional oncology procedures and has extensive expertise in the technical aspects of intratumoral therapy delivery. Finally, Dr. Douglas Johnson, Professor of Medicine and Director of the Melanoma Clinical Research Program at Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center in Nashville, Tennessee, co-leads research initiatives focused on therapeutic biomarkers and strategies to overcome treatment resistance in melanoma. Together, these experts will outline the current melanoma treatment landscape, discuss challenges related to immune checkpoint inhibitor resistance, and provide practical guidance for integrating intratumoral injections into clinical practice. The idea that viruses could be harnessed to fight cancer isn't new. In fact, it dates back over a century. As early as the 1900s, physicians noted patients with leukemia and lymphoma who experienced temporary remission after contracting viral illnesses like influenza, measles, or varicella. In one striking case from 1971, a child with Burkitt lymphoma experienced a complete remission following an infection with measles, suggesting a possible link between viral infection and tumor regression. While these remissions were brief, they still hinted at an opportunity to look closer at using viruses as a new approach to treat cancer. But the ideal virus used to make oncolytic viral therapies must meet a few basic criteria. First, it must be selective to tumor cells and non-pathogenic to normal cells. The virus also has to be genetically stable and capable of being eradicated with antiviral medications as a safety net. Finally, the ideal virus should be non-transmissible. This is why researchers have focused heavily on HSV-1 as a suitable candidate. HSV-1 has a large double-stranded DNA genome that remains stable with genetic modifications. HSV-1 can be engineered to retarget cancer cells through surface glycoproteins, and it is sensitive to antivirals. It's also an ideal choice because it doesn't integrate into a patient's DNA and is capable of triggering modest immune responses, making it useful not just for killing tumor cells directly, but also for training the immune system to recognize and attack cancerous tumors elsewhere in the body. Currently, the landscape of intratumoral therapies for melanoma is rapidly evolving, with therapeutic vaccines and oncolytic viruses leading the total number of ongoing and planned clinical trials. Among these therapies, agents like T-VEC and RP1 are demonstrating encouraging results, signaling a promising future for patients with advanced melanoma.
The current treatment landscape has really changed over the last few years, although it kind of has settled out over the most recent two or three, at least for the frontline setting. And that's really, we lean on immunotherapy combinations as our first-line treatment options at this point for advanced melanoma. And really, the decision point often comes down to whether the patient should get a combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab or a combination of nivolumab and relatlimab. And those are PD-1 and CTLA-4 and then PD-1 and LAG-3 inhibitor combinations, respectively. Both of those can induce durable responses in somewhere around half of patients, and they both seem to be better than single-agent anti-PD-1 therapy. And it's still controversial which one to select. Among those two, we tend to lean towards the combination of ipi-nivo for patients that have brain metastases. But otherwise, I would say it's in some ways a dealer's choice between those two agents. We sometimes will use BRAF and MEK inhibitors in the front line as well for patients that have very bulky or symptomatic disease, or for perhaps for patients who progress through adjuvant anti-PD-1, although ipilimumab and nivolumab can also be included in those patients as well. So for patients who have progressed on available therapies in terms of the immunotherapy combinations and if applicable BRAF and MEK inhibitor therapies, then we're developing new therapies in the refractory setting as well. We sometimes use the oncolytic virus T-VEC when there's very low volume disease. And one of the more recently approved agents is lifileucel, which is a tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte therapy, which takes a tumor, harvests the immune cells from the tumor, and then gives it back to the patient along with high-dose chemotherapy. And those are associated with about a third of patients having durable responses. There are a number of clinical trials that we'll probably get into in the future, but that's the current landscape at the moment.
Staying updated on the latest melanoma therapies is essential for healthcare professionals. Dr. Najjar emphasizes the value of CME in helping clinicians to integrate rapidly advancing treatments, ultimately leading to improved patient outcomes in the years ahead.
Every immunotherapy that I can think of was first approved in melanoma, be it in the metastatic setting, adjuvant stage 3, adjuvant stage 2, bispecifics, tebentafusp is the first, cell therapy, lifileucel is the first, combos, ipi-nivo, combo, relanivo, on and on and on. And that gives you a sense of how quickly melanoma has moved and has really led the charge with immunotherapy. And I am the first to say, and I say it literally every day, I have no idea how community oncologists do what they do. And I completely tip my hat to them because the amount of information they keep up with across all diseases is just unfathomable to me. Add to that how quickly melanoma is moving and that it's not a rare disease. It's the fifth most common in the US in women and men. This is something that community oncologists see all the time. And we know that most melanoma is treated in the community, not in academic centers. And so I think that CME for melanoma and other cutaneous malignancies is really critical for the physicians taking care of these patients to be up to date in a field that is changing so rapidly.
Despite impressive gains in melanoma survival rates, therapeutic resistance remains a substantial challenge, limiting long-term success with advanced tumors. Resistance to frontline immune checkpoint inhibitors typically occurs in two forms, primary and acquired resistance. Primary resistance happens in roughly 40 to 65% of patients, while acquired resistance occurs in 20 to 30% of patients. Immunotherapy resistance often results from tumor intrinsic changes, like mutations that impair antigen presentation or disrupt interferon signaling. Also, tumor extrinsic factors, like changes in the tumor microenvironment, play a key role by fostering immunosuppression. On the other hand, genetic heterogeneity is an example of a tumor intrinsic change that contributes significantly to resistance. So, as frontline agents eliminate the treatment-sensitive tumors, resistant subpopulations that survive can expand and drive tumor progression. Putting this all together, let's say a patient initially responds to anti-PD-1 therapy but later progresses due to residual tumor cells with mutations in JAK1. This results in lower levels of tumor PD-L1 expression and evasion from the immune system, leading to acquired resistance. Dr. Johnson describes some of these clinical challenges and highlights some of the strategies he uses in his practice.
Resistance to anti-PD-1 therapy in melanoma is a real problem, and we sometimes think of this in terms of primary versus acquired resistance. Primary resistance being the patient really never responds to therapy or rapidly progresses in the context of adjuvant therapy. And acquired resistance would be a patient who initially responds to treatment but then unfortunately progresses, or perhaps a patient who, after finishing adjuvant therapy, has progression on anti-PD-1 therapy. Now, really figuring out how to address and overcome resistance remains one of the biggest challenges, but some ways we think about doing this is, for example, if a patient has only received single agent anti-PD-1, we will add a CTLA-4 inhibitor to the anti-PD-1. That does result in responses, including durable responses in about a third of patients. We can also add a LAG-3 inhibitor to anti-PD-1, although unfortunately this only is associated with somewhere around 10 to 12% response rate. We also think about TIL therapy as well, lifileucel, which is a tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte therapy that where the patient basically can receive their own lymphocytes from the tumor back, and with the goal of activating those lymphocytes to treat the metastatic disease. But we still really don't have a smoking gun answer to deal with PD-1 inhibitor resistance at this point. The other, of course, approach would be to sort of completely switch gears from immune therapy at all and move to targeted therapy with something like a BRAF and MEK inhibitor.
While we await the development of the smoking gun that takes care of anti-PD-1 resistance, we can find ways to maximize the efficacy of the treatment options we currently have available. One such method that proves promising is the use of intratumoral injections. Intratumoral injections with agents like oncolytic viruses can help tackle checkpoint inhibitor resistance directly. By inducing cell lysis of infected tumor cells, these therapies account for issues like tumor heterogeneity and expose the body's immune cells to the melanoma-specific neoantigens and mount systemic immune responses against metastatic lesions, even if they were not injected. T-VEC, the first oncolytic viral agent approved for intratumoral injection in patients with unresectable melanoma, is built from a genetically engineered herpes simplex virus that expresses GM-CSF and helps stimulate an immune response against tumor cells. Results from the Optum study demonstrated improved durable response rates of 16% with intratumoral injection of T-VEC compared with 2% with GM-CSF alone.
Oncolytic viruses are an interesting and novel therapy approach that's really only been used thus far, at least successfully, in melanoma. And we have one approved agent at this point. The full name is telimogene laherpepvec, or T-VEC for short. And it's a modified herpes simplex type 1 virus that we routinely use in the clinic. Now, it's mostly used for patients that have superficial lesions that could be identified, seen, and felt in the clinic and injected. And if you select the patients correctly, you can really cause responses in a fairly high percentage of patients. Somewhere around 50% of injected lesions will have a response. Although patients who have visceral disease, we really don't have a lot of success in that context. It's really the superficial lesions that we do see some success with T-VEC. So there are some more novel oncolytic virus therapies, such as RP1 is one of those, where we are not only using them in terms of injecting the external lesions, we're also working with our interventional radiology colleagues to inject visceral lesions that can be harder to get to from more traditional oncolytic viruses or other injectable therapies. And there really seems to be some added activity to this kind of approach, where we see in patients who have anti-PD-1 resistance, we see about a 40% response with the combination of anti-PD-1 plus RP1. So this is based on relatively small amounts of data in terms of small patient numbers, but there's a confirmatory phase 3 ongoing looking at anti-PD-1 plus RP1 that hopefully will show continued promising results. The idea for doing this is that there's been many injectable therapies over the years that we can inject into tumors, whether they're superficial or deep, and we know that they can work pretty well for the injected tumor. The problem is you can't inject every metastatic lesion in most cases, and of course we know that metastatic cancer is more of a systemic process rather than a localized process. And so what's interesting about these new oncolytic viruses is that they potentially stimulate a larger immune response beyond what is just injected. And so combining those with agents like anti-PD-1 and perhaps other therapies in the future is a really interesting option, and certainly does seem to have some promise.
RP1 is the most recent oncolytic viral therapy which is currently under priority review for FDA approval. The phase 2 IGNITE trial looked at the combination of RP1 with nivolumab in patients with unresectable or advanced stage melanomas who progressed on PD-1 inhibitor therapy. Patients received intratumoral injections of RP1 every 2 weeks for up to 8 cycles in combination with nivolumab. At a median follow-up of 15 months, the study reported an overall response rate of 33%, including a complete response rate of 15% and a partial response rate of 18%. Responses occurred in both injected and non-injected lesions, demonstrating the ability of RP1 to mount a robust systemic immune response. This finding was pivotal because it showed that combination treatment with RP1 and anti-PD-1 therapy was still efficacious regardless of prior exposure to immune checkpoint inhibitors. Dr. Najjar tells us how she explains the unique mechanism of action of oncolytic viral therapies like RP1 to patients in her clinic.
RP1, of course, is an oncolytic immunotherapy, and it's a clinical isolate of HSV1, which is modified in order to express a fusogenic glycoprotein and other immune stimulating responses. And I explained to the patient that this idea of injecting a virus into a tumor is really not a new idea. We've been doing this for a very long time. We're attempting to do it for a very long time. And in fact, we started doing this with bacteria, with Coli's toxin in the 1800s. And the whole idea, as I put it to the patient, is that when you inject an infectious substance into a tumor, the idea is that that will drive the immune system to do what it has failed to do so far, which is to recognize that there's a problem there, specifically a cancer. So I explain it to the patient as by injecting virus or bacterial agents into tumors, our hope is that we're taking the blinders off of the immune system so that it can do what it was supposed to do in the first place. And for RP1 in particular, with the way that it's been modified, I think of it as a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, you have a dysregulated host antiviral response, which we know about in the tumor tissue, and that's allowing for robust viral replication, tumor lysis, release of neoantigen, local inflammation, increased T-cell infiltration, and that's why we think we see part of the systemic effects there. But at the same time, in healthy tissues, you have an intact antiviral host response. And so you have the normal tissues remaining undamaged. So you're very selectively going after the tumor tissue. And because of this higher infection rate of tumor cells, alteration of the tumor microenvironment, as you alluded to, turning the cold tumor hot, although certainly it's more complicated than that, we see generation of a strong anti-tumor response, not just locally, but also more systemically.
Dr. Najjar then talks us through identifying which patients may benefit most from these treatments, as well as the rationale for combining RP1 with immune checkpoint inhibitors.
I would say when I think about my practice, there are modalities where it's the minority of patients who are eligible for a certain modality. With oncolytic viral therapy, I think of it as probably the majority of patients are eligible if they have something that we can access for injection. You need to either be able to access the tumor superficially or subcutaneously. We do this in clinic all the time. Or depending on the oncolytic viral therapy you're considering, there are some certainly where we do visceral injections with ultrasound or CT guidance from our interventional radiology colleagues. So I think number one is you need to have a target that is injectable. Number two, of course, I think quite logically, you don't want the patient to be immunosuppressed because you are introducing a viral therapy. I will say, for example, with RP1, there have not been any reports of patients or caregivers becoming infected. So I think that's more of a theoretical concern, but I think quite logically, you know, you don't introduce infectious agents into patients who are immunosuppressed. The rationale for combining oncolytic immunotherapy with more standard, if you will, immunotherapies such as anti-PD-1 immunotherapy is that you're intervening at distinct points of the cancer immunity cycle. This is certainly true of oncolytic viral therapy and IO and melanoma, but the broader principle of targeting non-overlapping distinct parts of the cancer immunity cycle, I think, is a very important principle in oncology. So as we spoke about earlier, when you have oncolytic viral therapy, what is happening is not just tumor lysis, but release of neoantigen into the, not just the TME, but also more systemically, presumably in the peripheral system, and also activation of different T cell subsets. and other immune cell subsets. Once a T cell, however, gets into the tumor, and this is not just the injected tumor, this is also other tumors, if PD-1 on the T cell binds to PD-L1 on the tumor cell, we know that you then have dampening of T cell receptor signaling, and you end up with an immune cell that cannot do its job. And therein lies the rationale for the combination. The oncolytic virotherapy is allowing a more systemic, if you will, immune cell activation. Whereas what the immunotherapy is doing is by the time the T cell is infiltrating the tumor, it is protected by the anti-PD-1 blockade from the PD-1, PD-L1 axis so that the T cell can in fact do its job instead of having been activated by an oncolytic virotherapy coming into the TME and not being able to do what it is supposed to do because PD-L1 is dampening that T cell receptor signaling via PD-1. So the rationale there is really very logical to my mind.
If you're ever unsure about referring a patient to IR for intratumoral injections, it never hurts to talk to them and discuss the case.
I would say, first and foremost, you know, engage your local, friendly neighborhood interventional radiologist. They will be excited to know about RP1 if they don't know about it, because this is something, like I said, I think many of us in the field, you know, across practice sites and training programs and generations, feel in our bones is something that, you know, we can't accomplish with image-guided therapies. It's just been a struggle so far. And so when you can show them the RP1 data, I think you will stimulate a lot of excitement and, willingness to participate in these programs. And then two, sort of hand in hand, be aware that the complexities and the safety concerns that a melanoma medical oncologist may feel about these intramural therapies are usually not shared by IRs, in the sense that we feel this can be done very, very safely. And so don't hesitate again to reach out to your friendly IR to see if they can and will be willing to deliver this for your patients.
Ultimately, identifying candidates for oncolytic viral therapy involves careful consideration of patient factors along with your best clinical judgment. However, individuals who are pregnant, those with active herpetic infections, or patients experiencing severe immunosuppression from HIV or hematologic cancers should typically be excluded. As direct tumor injections gain more widespread adoption, clear and standardized communication between interventional radiologists and medical oncologists is crucial. Dr. Najjar and Dr. Johnson share some practical approaches for streamlining this collaboration to ensure patients are receiving optimal care.
When we first started to see the advent of oncolytic virotherapy into the clinic, for example, with T-VEC, these were not done viscerally in the standard of care setting. And so we were very used to doing the injections ourselves as oncologists. With the newer iterations, with oncolytic virotherapy 2.0, if you will, we are injecting into more visceral lesions routinely. And so it cannot be done as well as we can do it without very clear buy-in from our interventional radiology colleagues, and perhaps even more importantly, very clear lines of communications between us and them. The way it works now, and of course this is being done in the setting of clinical trials so far, is we communicate with interventional radiology from day one, and we will say, I have patient X, I am considering therapy Y, can we please look over at the scans? And we literally walk over and look at the scans with them, and say which injections are feasible to you. And these are the ones that I think we should go through. And we then will work with IR scheduling to find a time quite quickly, because obviously they're very busy and very booked up. But from the very beginning, we start with an eye to the schedule so that we can have a slot for that patient. It can't possibly work if you're not working very closely together. And we have the good fortune here of having phenomenal IR colleagues. And certainly that's the same for, I would imagine, all academic sites. And in the community, we're really going to have to figure out how to have that workflow between MedOnc and IR. Now, I appreciate that this is not, these are not capabilities that every site has, but I think it's something that's increasingly going to be coming into the realm of standard of care and not just clinical trial. What role does the multidisciplinary tumor board play? To my mind, it plays a big role in every malignancy, cutaneous or otherwise. But I think here in particular, it's also very important because you have medical oncology and IR, you have a templated time where we're sitting together and looking at a patient scan and making these decisions in real time. As an oncologist, I appreciate I'm biased here, but certainly I think that it's going to be the oncologists who ultimately are deciding on the therapy because we have been taking care of these patients from the time of diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera. I imagine it would be med onc who are the ones to be driving this train, for example, saying, I think we should be doing oncolytic virotherapy next. But it's with IR hand in hand that we're going to decide what to go after and what number of tumors, what volume of injectate, how are we rotating the tumors from injection to injection, and so on.
Certainly, the multidisciplinary tumor board is incredibly important when making treatment decisions when there are multiple specialists involved. And we certainly do this in a situation where a melanoma is locally advanced and we need to think about neoadjuvant therapy versus surgery versus some combination of the two. We need to do this when we're thinking about a symptomatic lesion that might need radiation versus surgery versus continued systemic therapy. And then this new indication for thinking about oncolytic viruses when a patient might need those therapies and need an injection by our interventional radiology colleagues or perhaps surgical oncology using ultrasound guidance. Identifying who the right person to do this, whether it can be done safely, it will be a key need, especially as these agents become more and more widespread. So multidisciplinary tumor boards are also important when we're thinking about something like TIL therapy in terms of identifying what the right patients are for a surgical resection of these tumors for TILs, who can be done safely, and then also whether the patient's a good candidate.
From an interventional radiologist's viewpoint, effective communication during the treatment process significantly enhances the precision, safety, and success of intratumoral injections. Dr. Sheth weighs in on the role of IR in this collaborative treatment approach.
Yes, it's been exciting to see IR find relevance in new cancers, and melanoma is one. I think that is a really good example of that. Right now, there is one intratumoral immunotherapy that's approved for melanoma patients, which is, of course, T-VEC. Most of the time, those are delivered into cutaneous lesions, but there are some that require image guidance because they're subcutaneous, they can't be palpated. And that's kind of the main way right now in which we participate in the care of these melanoma patients is assisting with the image guided delivery of T-VEC for metastatic melanoma. We certainly have a broader toolkit which can be relevant for melanoma patients, but I think in terms of the kind of frontline and most common ways that we can treat now, as well as we can grow in the future, that's the best application. It's easier to get involved sooner rather than later, as you can imagine. So the sooner that we can know about the patient through our relationship with the melanoma medical oncologist, who of course is the primary team and who is running the show, then the better, because many of these protocols for intratumoral injection require weekly or biweekly interventions. Of course, schedules being as they are and just the logistics of an interventional suite, it's better to know things in advance so that we can schedule these patients in a timely manner. And then that way we can deliver the care as best as possible and keep it convenient for the patients.
Choosing which lesions to target first is a key decision for the team to make. Dr. Sheth and Dr. Najjar give their approaches to collaborating more effectively while planning out the treatment course.
There is a mismatch between the way we in interventional radiology would choose lesions as the medical oncologist might. What I mean by that is there's a very different consideration of the safety and risk of these interventions between people like me and IR and medical oncologists. I think there's a higher degree of concern for medical oncologists about what is safe. And in general, I think if you ask IRs like myself, and this is true for virtually any IR coming out of any training program without any specific, additional training, I think most would say that it's safe to stick a needle and deliver these intratumoral therapies in just about anywhere. And obviously that's an intended exaggeration, but I think in general, that's That's true. And so typically, safety is the first thing we think about for lesion selection. But for most IRs, I think you can essentially scratch that concern off the list for just about every site of possible injection. So then it becomes much more important and interesting to choose lesions based on the anticipated response. So whether that's the local response to the drug or the potential for systemic immunostimulation and kickstarting responses in off-target non-injected lesions, those become priorities. So things like metabolically active, new lesions, growing lesions, as well as lesions that are symptomatic. So if it's causing pain or about to impinge on something that can lead to negative consequences, then those become the reasons to choose specific lesions as opposed to, oh, let's start with the safest, most easiest lesion. Because I would say for most IRs, that would apply to just about anything.
The first thing I think about is that I want to inject as many lesions as I can over the course of the patient's treatment, because of course we know very well that there's considerable heterogeneity, not just within one tumor, but across different tumors in the same patient. So the more neoantigen you can release, the more T cell activation you can get, I think the more your odds are, quite logically, of hitting that point, that tipping point of it translating into clinical response. What we do in clinic is we, first of all, talk to our colleagues in IR and we see what is accessible. And I certainly have had patients where we are going after cutaneous subcutaneous lesions that we can access as physicians or physician assistant colleagues in the clinic. And also, if there are metabolically active, more visceral tumors as well. We also think carefully about rotating the number of lesions that we're injecting, and we routinely inject more than one tumor at a time. We also tend to prioritize, as a broad rule of thumb, going after the bigger lesions, which are often the more metabolically active lesions.
Lesions are typically chosen based on accessibility, size, amount of necrosis, and metabolic activity on PET imaging. Targetable lesions should be at least 1 centimeter for solid tumors or 1.5 centimeters for lymph nodes. Lesions should also be located away from dangerous anatomy, which would make the procedure high risk for injury. Other tumor factors to consider are the stromal composition and density of the target lesions, which can be characterized before the procedure with contrast-enhanced CT or MRI imaging. However, the best way to visualize the tumor's microstructure is with diffusion-weighted imaging. Ultrasonography with Doppler can also be useful, especially for identifying necrotic areas to avoid during injections. Using a single end-hole needle with a fanning technique is the most common technique for these injections, but very dense tumors may need injection into the peripheral tumor edge to get the best coverage.
In terms of the tumor composition, it's a great question. It's one that I think has more questions than answers at this point. Absolutely, we know that the tumor's physical properties affect the way in which drugs penetrate that tumor. We've known that for decades for systemic therapies, and it's certainly also the case for intratumoral therapies. So just because you stick a needle in it doesn't necessarily mean you overcome all those barriers for delivery. As we've seen with some of these injections, you still get profound local and systemic immune responses. And so it's not preventing us from kind of igniting that local immune response, which is fantastic. There are certainly there are certainly ways that we can improve upon it, and those are like rich areas for research. But it is something that doesn't, thankfully doesn't limit us in terms of the efficacy of the intratumoral therapies. Each therapy, both whether standard of care or on a clinical trial, has a little bit of a different schedule. The highest frequency that we do this would be once a week, and then otherwise it's twice a week or even more spaced out than that. The frequency is not necessarily the rate limiting step as long as you have enough advance notice. So with advance notice, you can schedule these patients because they're very quick procedures. They don't, occupy a room for very long at all. And so it's not terribly burdensome to put them on the schedule, but again, with sufficient advance notice. The most important thing in this regard, though, of course, is being able to coordinate with all the other necessary steps that occur for these patients. And so, for example, with T-VEC or other oncolytic viruses, if the patient is going to have to be seen by their medical oncologist before the delivery on the same day, then we try to get them as the first appointment with that medical oncologist so that doesn't delay things on our end, which of course is not necessarily possible. Likewise, it has to be prepared by pharmacy, basically right then and there. It can't be prepared ahead of time. So that again takes time. So we don't schedule these injections as first cases. Usually we start around maybe 10 at the earliest, and then go from there. It's not something that often goes on time, to be honest, as it is right now, because like we just talked about, there's many steps that have to happen first. So they're often delayed, and we may have to be literally rushing the patient into the room because the drug's going to expire before we can do the delivery. So there are important sort of timekeeping issues that do arise. And so we try to schedule around it and accommodate. But being much more flexible with the way in which we handle the drug and prepare it and have it available for us would make all the difference in the world in terms of the flexibility for our scheduling.
Just like Dr. Sheth pointed out, organizing your schedule to administer these injections can be challenging, especially when the shelf life of these agents is narrow and needs timely coordination with pharmacists to store and prepare the oncolytic viruses. Dr. Sheth also talks more about how this process could be improved in the future.
Yeah, so the workflow for intratumoral injections, especially things like oncolytic viruses that have to be thawed and then have a limited use time, right now is not optimized. And there are certainly ways to improve upon it. In general, everything happens serially rather than parallel. So the way in which the patients are seen, the orders are placed, the orders have been released to pharmacy, the pharmacy then prepares it and then sends it to IR. Each one of those things has to happen one after another, which, like with anything, if one thing gets derailed, it just leads to the snowball effect until, the patient is waiting around for hours before their drug is ready, even though, they showed up on time and they're doing everything right from their end. So there's certainly efficiencies that can be had by making things in parallel, by offsetting things so they don't have to happen, one after another, as well as improving the shelf life for these oncolytic viruses. So whether that's their time in a fridge or even time at room temperature, if those things are improved, then it makes it much easier to not only stick on time for each patient, but also to scale this so that if, it doesn't have to require a minus 80 fridge at every site, then it becomes this sort of spoken wheel method for community hospitals becomes much more practical. And even for, big tertiary centers like where I work with, if we're able to have hazard fridges where we can just keep this drug immediately available or even store it overnight so that it's available for the patient when they show up the next day, those sort of improvements based on the kind of biosafety make a world of difference in terms of the scalability of this. So I would say, in short, it is a large area that can be improved upon and which I think will have important consequences for how this gets adopted and used.
As mentioned earlier, the risks of the intratumoral injections are similar to performing a needle biopsy, but certain immune-related toxicities are important to watch for after oncolytic viral injections.
Biopsy is about as bread and butter as it gets for IR, not to say it's not an important procedure. It's an extraordinarily important procedure for the care of the patient, but it is kind of as, it's lowest on the complexity scale of just about anything we do in IR. And at Anderson alone, we do about 10,000 biopsies a year. These injections, I think most IRs would agree, is actually even lower on the complexity scale than a biopsy. So it's, you take kind of a procedure that is as bread and butter as it gets, and you kind of take it down even one more notch. So from a complexity standpoint, it is, as straightforward as one could hope for, which I think is fantastic because, the complexity is in the therapy we're delivering, not in the delivery of it itself, which I think is the right way, this should be set up. So it is, of course, anything can happen. The likelihood of a major complication from these types of interventions is exceedingly rare. And when we looked at our own experience with this for the first 500 patients, and this is what we're talking about, years ago, we had literally zero complications related to the intervention. And that, that resonates with our previous literature in terms of needle-guided or image-guided needle-based procedures like biopsies. We know the safety profile of that, and we know that they're extraordinarily safe. So I think from an interventional procedural standpoint, the safety is fantastic. But of course, we are dealing with a live agent, and we're dealing with an immune active agent. And so you can have toxicities related to the agent. They're in our experience, uncommon, but they're things that may not be familiar to an interventionalist. And if they haven't used these types of therapies before, they haven't seen cytokine storm, and they haven't seen these kind of potential inflammatory responses that can occur quite rapidly. So there is a bit of, I think, training and knowledge that needs to be imparted when folks are building their program from scratch, because they need to be familiar with what that constellation of immune-related toxicities looks like and how they're managed, because it is quite different than the profile of toxicities we're used to from our other interventions. But these are things that can be, easily taught and readily managed. I think beyond the kind of procedural suite and the immediate recovery, this is where we, of course, rely heavily on our medical oncologists, because this is something that they see and, live and breathe every day to help manage.
Accurate and detailed post-procedure documentation is crucial, especially for maintaining continuity of care between providers. Dr. Sheth shares best practices for documenting key findings, like the lesions that were targeted, injection volumes used, and unexpected findings that can help the next IR continue the injections.
So like we talked about, these, I think the main point is, and sort of should be made, is that these procedures are extraordinarily safe. That's kind of the most important thing to walk away from. And that's not just for superficial lesions, but also for visceral reasons as well. So liver, lung, deep lymph node, pelvic, whatever. They can all be done very safely, and certainly from a procedural standpoint, which I mean, sticking a needle into the spot is also very, very safe. But like we said, these are immune active agents, and so you can have immune related toxicities, or you can have flare ups of pre-existing sort of checkpoint related toxicities as well. We've seen that before, so that's where things can get concerning, especially if you haven't seen this, in the past, because you're building up your tumoral immunotherapy program and you just haven't seen enough. And so SIRS would be the most dramatic one. And so patients can get tachycardic, short of breath, their O2 sounds can start to fall, their oxygen requirements start to increase, and that can happen rapidly after injection. Again, extraordinarily uncommon, but it is possible. And that's where the management of situations like that are important to be familiar with, if you're doing these procedures. In general, the patients follow our biopsy post-procedure management algorithms, which just depend on where you do the delivery. So if it's lung or liver, it's like a 3-hour observation. If it's other sort of deep lesions that are not in those solid organs, it's usually just 1-hour observation in our PACU, and then they're good to go. It's funny, it's the small stuff that I think makes the big difference, because what you want to do is not just do the delivery, but you also want to be assessing efficacy and helping plan the next round of therapies simultaneously. And so that's where, as banal as it sounds, documentation is kind of the key here. And it doesn't take a lot of documentation. It just takes a little bit of organization. Something as simple as tables, where you have, okay, today was cycle 3. I injected this lesion. Here's this series and image number from the CT scan that lesion is. I injected this amount of therapeutic. And then, for next week, when the patient comes back for cycle 4, the plan is to inject, that lesion on that series and image number, and this amount of volume is what's planned, and then have, a space there to also add comments, because, very excitingly, these lesions do resolve and go away. So you can say, today we injected, this lesion, it's really small now, and I would suggest next time don't inject it, because it's basically gone. So ways to communicate that in the medical record, I think go a very long way, because you can't plan cycle eight, before you start cycle one. There's going to be sort of dynamic processes that occur during that that treatment period where you have to be able to be a little bit more nimble than that. And so, something as straightforward as a table that documents each cycle, what was injected, how much, and any changes that would affect decision making for the next round, I think are just part and parcel of this procedure.
Safety concerns are always top of mind when considering any therapy, and intratumoral injections are no exception. The most common adverse events from the IGNITE study on RP1 included mostly grade 1 or grade 2 adverse events, such as mild constitutional symptoms and local injection site reactions. Although severe immune reactions are rare, clinicians should always be vigilant. Also, concerns over transmitting herpetic infections to healthcare staff and caregivers after oncolytic viruses were addressed in a study by Bomarity and colleagues, which looked at viral shedding in patients from the IGNITE trial who received RP1.
The question of transmission of herpetic infection comes up a lot, and I make it a point to tell every patient that there have been no reports, as we alluded to earlier, of patients or caregivers becoming infected with the herpes virus. What I also tell patients as well is that there were trials done with RP1, for example, in particular, where even when the DNA was detected in various bodily fluids, there was actually no live virus at all that was found. And so I think that's very reassuring when we tell people that. Best practices, I think it's very common sense. We do these injections in clinic all the time. And of course, we wear gloves, we wear PPE, as we would when administering any biologic agent to a patient. But we are not, locking the rooms and bleaching them down or anything like that. It's quite standard, universal cleaning precautions, and the same for personal protection. In terms of adverse events, it appears that oncolytic viruses are quite well tolerated. We certainly see some evidence of injection site reactions, erythema, swelling or edema, some tenderness, constitutional symptoms such as headaches, fatigues, fevers, chills, but I have not observed, nor has it been reported thus far, that there are significant or severe adverse events, nor does it appear that there is, if you will, worsening of known irAEs from immunotherapy when you add on an oncolytic viral therapy.
While remarkable progress has been made, significant unmet needs persist. We are still lacking reliable biomarkers capable of detecting potential resistance early, which happens to be a special topic of interest for Dr. Johnson, who actively leads research in this area.
Well, there are a number of key unmet needs in the treatment of melanoma. We've certainly come a long way with the advent of combination immunotherapy, where many patients are having deep and durable responses. But unfortunately, many patients still do not respond to treatment. And so several unmet needs can include things like biomarkers, which patients will respond, which patients need new and aggressive treatments. Thinking about biomarkers at the time of resistance, so understanding why a patient develops progression, why a patient develops resistance, and what might be the best therapy for that particular patient. There's been a number of clinical trials and other available therapies that do show somewhere between 10 and 30% response rate in these contexts, but we really don't have any way of profiling patients and stratifying patients by which would be the most effective therapy for that individual patient. The big picture, though, would be we just need better therapies for patients who have progression on anti-PD-1 therapy, especially in the setting of combination therapy.
The future of melanoma treatment is exciting, with ongoing research into combination immunotherapies, oncolytic viruses, personalized vaccines, and adoptive cell therapies pushing the boundaries of what's achievable.
There is so much coming down the pike in melanoma, which is one of truly the great pleasures of being in the space. And it's not just in the metastatic setting. I also think about major readouts in the neoadjuvant adjuvant setting. So perhaps we should start there. We know that S1801 and Nadina each have firmly established neoadjuvant therapy as superior to adjuvant alone in our treatment armamentarium. Those were practice-changing trials. In the adjuvant setting, for many years now, we have had approvals from pivotal phase threes for anti-PD-1 immunotherapies and also targeted therapy in the appropriate patient. But we very recently have learned, or I should say reaffirmed, that more is not necessarily better. For example, we knew that adjuvant Ipi/Nivo is not superior to adjuvant Nivo alone from Checkmate 915. And very recently, we learned the same lesson from Relativity 098. We learned that adjuvant relatlimab-nivolumab is not superior to adjuvant nivolumab alone. That's a major readout, excuse me, that's just come out. I'm also very eagerly awaiting data from the adjuvant vaccine trial. We had seen from KEYNOTE-942 in the earlier phase iteration, a very promising signal of EFS benefits when combining a personalized neoantigen vaccine with anti-PD-1 versus anti-PD-1 alone. And the phase 3 has finished enrolling, and we very eagerly await that data, which certainly could be practice changing. In the metastatic setting, there are so many readouts, and anything I don't mention is simply because of a lack of time. But we have trials in the front line, including for lifileucel immunotherapy. We also have the PRISM-MEL trial, which is looking at a PRAME bispecific molecule in the frontline setting compared to immunotherapy. In the IO refractory setting, a year ago, I would have said this is on the horizon, but now it's here, and that's lifileucel, giving a objective response rate of about 30% in the appropriate patient. And certainly that's not every patient, but it's a great option to have. We have RP1 with anti-PD-1, which looked promising in the phase 2 IGNITE trial, on the basis of which there's now a PDUFA date for July 22nd, I believe. There is the phase 3 IGNITE trial that is ongoing to confirm those findings in a much more rigorous, robust way, obviously, phase 3 versus phase 2. We have trials of tebentafusp and anti-PD-1 in the IO refractory setting. We also have multiple next gen, if you will, cell therapies. And one that comes to mind now is Immatics, with early phase data looking quite promising. This was published quite recently in one of the Nature journals just a couple of weeks ago. And so I could go on and on, but suffice it to say that there is very much coming down the pike for how we treat this disease, not just in the metastatic setting, not just in the IO refractory setting, but also in earlier stages of disease for prevention of recurrence.
Well, there are many things that are exciting in melanoma right now. So certainly triplet therapy, thinking about the combination of PD-1 plus CTLA-4 plus LAG-3. We don't have much data at this point, and the toxicities may be too severe, but the response rates seem to be quite high, and we really don't have a great sense of how significant the toxicities are going to be. There are next-generation TIL products that are just starting to read out in terms of products that allow you to spare interleukin-2, or perhaps decrease the amount of chemotherapy, or perhaps harvest TILs through biopsies rather than a surgical resection. I think all of these therapies will change the way we treat melanoma, especially in the refractory setting, but I think even in the future for frontline agents as well. So I think the future is bright for melanoma. We're certainly hoping for a future that where really nobody dies of metastatic melanoma or it becomes extremely rare.
Given the numerous clinical trials currently underway, melanoma specialists remain optimistic about upcoming innovations. Thank you for taking the time to join today's conversation on the exciting developments in intratumoral therapies for advanced melanoma. We hope you were able to take away practical knowledge that can translate into improved patient care in your practice.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.